When did you start bringing everything downstairs, just so you don't have to go back upstairs again? Joint Relief Institute. Move better, live better without surgery. Call 708-888-0000.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you're here. Thanks for joining us this week. Two authors today. Johnny Compton writes horror fantasy stories, and his latest is called Dead First. Now, I can hear you. I know what you might be saying. You're saying horror isn't your thing, but just listen to his response to that. He says you're probably reading horror stories all the time. It set me back. I'm interested in what you think of that. Also in this episode, we hear from novelist Jordy Rosenberg. Now, Jordy's created a fantastic character who might actually be his mom. In the novel, Barbara Rosenberg, notice the same last name, Barbara Rosenberg is dying, and she tells her story from two perspectives. One is a very funny, disgruntled Jewish woman in New York looking back on her life's disappointments in a way that's sure to make you laugh. And then the other is funny as well and poignant, is a present-day Barbara hopped up on painkillers as she waits to die. Both characters complain about their child, whose sexuality they consider their biggest disappointment in their lives. In this book are bits of conversation that Jordy had with his real-life mom.
At one point in my, you know, like late teens, early 20s, I thought I had gotten her. I thought, all right, here's the talking point that she's just not going to be able to argue with. And I think I said, look, I don't like sleeping with men. And she said, and she really got me here, she said, no one likes sleeping with men. Just marry one and divorce him for the alimony.
In the end, both authors ultimately are dealing with family in their books. We'll start with Johnny Compton. Johnny, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I got to tell you, when I was getting started to talk to you, I was reading the book, and I thought I would start by saying that I don't really read much horror, and this was kind of my introduction to it. I enjoyed it. Edge of my seat, all of that. But then I read a quote from you that you said that horror is kind of incorporated in most popular fiction that we read. You got me thinking about that. Explain yourself.
I think I'm glad you found that quote. It's one of my favorite things to say because I understand a lot of people are squeamish about horror and they're uncomfortable with it. It's not everybody's thing. That said, for the most part, if you are into some kind of fiction or storytelling that has life or death stakes, horror is incorporated, whether it's something as serious and as sometimes dire as Game of Thrones and the book series associated with it, or something as light as basically any Disney movie. There are full compilations on YouTube of all the scariest scenes from all the Disney movies, dating back to Snow White, obviously, and The Witch, and how terrifying that could be. And I know when I was a kid, Pinocchio has multiple things that have scarred me still to this
day. Right, that's a scary movie.
It's terrifying. So yeah, horror is in everything a little bit.
So is horror and our sort of attraction to it, whether it's Sleeping Beauty or Dead First, kind of our dance with death or our flirting with death? I mean, is there a relationship there?
I definitely think so. I know it is for me to a certain extent. Somebody asked me a while back why they thought that I wrote horror, and I tried to come up with a lot of different things, and then I realized I've been fascinated with it ever since I was a kid, and I don't think it's too much of a coincidence that the first time I fell in love with a ghost story was also the first year of my life. I had really severe asthma as a kid, and I was in the hospital for an extended period of time and could have died, and I don't think I quite understood my mortality then. I was like 5 years old. Sure. But I do think that there was this sense of, you know, I was definitely advised about certain things I needed to do to take care of myself or else I could get really sick again, and being in the hospital, you start immediately grasping the idea of this is really bad. And yet there's this fascination, like you said, the dance with death, the idea of a ghost and you can live on. And yet at the same time, the concept of living on through the ghost story is not a wonderful thing. It's not heaven, you know?
Right,
it's not
right.
Paradise. It's continued, usually some kind of sense of I didn't get my job done while I was on Earth and I have unfinished business. And that in its own way is a continuation of the suffering. It's a weird relationship we have with the concept of death through that and various other horror stories, especially supernatural horrors, from vampires to werewolves, all these other things where somehow we're escaping death and yet there's a curse associated with it at the same time.
Exactly. I mean, if it is a dance or whatever, it's not a reassuring dance, right?
No,
it's not comforting.
No. It's deliberately scary, and yet we encounter it in a way to kind of, I think, sort of the thrill ride aspect too. We want to get this sensation out of our system. We want to find a way to confront it because we know it's there in a manner that ultimately is still pretty safe. I mean, obviously, we're telling fake stories, so it's pretty safe.
I guess it's true.
The real world can be, yeah.
You know, thinking about it, they're horrific, but they generally end up positively, or right? And so there's a reassurance that way?
There's a lot of reassurance oftentimes, or if it ends still horrifically, even if it ends negatively, usually there's, I think, some level of catharsis or the expectation going in. It's kind of like I said, the thrill ride at the amusement park, the Tower of Terror kind of thing. I personally hate heights, uh-huh. And yet I've done that, and I know what's going to happen. I'm going to be taken up to the top of this tower and then dropped. And in my mind, this is the most horrifying thing that could possibly happen to me. I can't stand heights. But if I'm doing it in this avenue, this thing that still ends in this kind of horrifying sensation of getting dropped somehow fills me up with life in a way that makes me remember and feel like, you know, grateful for the moment. And I think that's part of what horror can deliver to us as well.
We're talking to Johnny Compton. The name of his latest book is Dead First. Okay, so I've been psychoanalyzing you while reading about you, wondering what drew you to horror, or maybe it's just drew you to writing. And I noticed that you were a military brat. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people who are going from place to place and don't have very strong roots, right, develop imaginations or imaginary friends, things like that. Did that have an impact on you?
100%. Man, that's a great observation. I definitely felt the need to kind of fill the gaps of not having some of those roots and some of those deep relationships by either inventing my own or diving so deep into the lore of a place. So much of the storytelling I do, there are elements from Dead First that are drawn directly from when I was in Mississippi and there was an allegedly haunted hospital that I've been fascinated with ever since I was a kid. And I incorporated stories that my friends told me about that hospital into Dead First. And that's my way of, even though I didn't live there long, and even though I didn't have those friends for very long, it's my way of still feeling connected all these years later. And I kind of get to cheat a little bit on the years that I lost and the time that I didn't get to establish myself there. I still get to have a connection of some kind with it. And, you know, that definitely, the writing fills the gap for a lot of those missing pieces, for sure.
Yeah, I grew up near a state mental institution as a kid, you know, 3 miles away in the country, and they would patients would escape and, you know, just walk up to your door or walk up to your house. So we always said that it was – or sometimes they would find, sadly, escapees who didn't make it through the cornfield, you know. So I kind of grew up with that real-life horror, too, I guess. I've wasted my potential. I've got all that material that I let go.
I mean, that is golden material. Yeah. You could definitely use that.
There was one time when we were playing basketball, kids on a driveway, and this guy came up and asked if he could play with us. And he started playing with us, and the dad knew, I mean, because you would just know, it was a small town. And they called the hospital. They came and picked him up and took him away.
That is unreal. That is one of those, I mean, it's at the same time, it's kind of the perfect level of it's scary, kind of the brush with this, how misunderstood this person might have been, who knows, all these kind of elements to it. And yet it's kind of the everyday element of these kind of things that I feel like really, I know I gravitate toward, where there's nothing really spectacular that happened there. It's just this fundamental, we know that this person escaped from this facility. Who knows what their situation might have been, and yet they came up to ask to play basketball with us, and we, you know, might not have realized how close we were to potentially danger or who knows what other kind of experience. Yeah. To me, those kind of there's nothing really over the top spectacular about it, and it's really grounded. That makes the story that much richer.
You can use that. Just give me a credit in the notes. Okay.
Definitely, 100%.
Shyla Sinclair. Is, I would say this is her story, right? This is her book?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Tell me about her.
She is a private detective, black woman living in Texas. And she has this unique dark past that we're not privy to initially, but we do learn it over the course of the book, and it very much influences the reasoning why she takes on this really bizarre case, obviously, in this supernatural horror story about this man who claims that he cannot be killed, and in fact demonstrates that perhaps he's true about that. But beyond this fantastical element, she has this very real-world tragic background, and that plants a seed of anger within her that is one of the biggest driving forces for this character. And for me, this was a fascinating way for me to explore my own potential anger issues and my own association with sometimes negative feelings that I feel like nonetheless are I'm trying to turn into a positive because I feel like they motivate me. And Shyla is definitely in that department where she has things that she probably needs to let go of or at least find a healthier way to cope.
Yeah.
And yet she feels like, what would I do without this anger, because it's my fuel.
It's interesting because she's trapped by this past that the rest of us might not hold her as accountable as she fears we would, right?
Yes.
And so she's kind of brainwashed or blackmailed into taking this job for, you talked about the Braith, Saxon Braith, the multimillionaire who is very rich, very powerful, and can't be killed, right?
Yes, yes.
And so he's never satisfied. Is that what we should see in him?
That is 100%. That is exactly it. That is it. What I wanted to establish at the beginning, his very opulent house that is decorated in a way where he doesn't even really have to have taste, because if you know, if you have enough money, you just throw it out there and you just say, I'm rich. I always kind of felt this way about, you know, not to take shots at anybody. I always kind of felt this way a little bit about certain fashion choices, though, where people I've known in my life and that I see on television, what have you, where it's like, yeah, this looks ridiculous, but it costs like $10,000.
Right.
So, who are you to tell me what?
Right.
And it's like, or even with cars, sometimes I'll see and I'm like, that doesn't really look that great, or that doesn't make much sense, but it's like, oh, like, well, it costs this much, and that's kind of the mask for it. And so he has all these things going, and on top of that, he can't die, and this should be the most satisfied person to ever exist. Like, I'm rich beyond belief, I can get anything I want, and also, by the way, I can't be killed, and yet something in him is incomplete, because he doesn't have control over the reasoning why he can't die. He has this amazing gift, but he doesn't know how he received it. So that's why he hires her, so he can understand this.
And we talked about her past and what her secrets are and things like that. I don't want to give anything away, but when it comes to Braith's part of it as well, the people pursuing Braith or the people involved in his story also are concerned about their parents and their parents before them, right?
Yes.
There's a generational thing here.
There's definitely an examination with this story in terms of a relationship of history, both your own personal history, generational history, and then even the larger history of just, you know, your state, your location, your wherever you're from. Something is, you know, you talked earlier about our relationship with ghost stories. Part of that, I think, the relationship with death is the nature of death, rebirth, the cycle, and how things that have come before us have been destroyed sometimes so that we can live. Mm-hmm. And what is our responsibility to that history and remembering it and doing justice maybe to people who had previous injustices, you know, occur to them. And that's the reason why we're able to thrive as much as, you know, we may or may not do so in a modern society.
So those are a couple of the characters. There's a woman named Jin as well. I'll leave that for the reader. But Texas is a character in this book, and different spots in Texas. And you schooled me on Galveston. Wow. I mean, I knew about the storm. I didn't know about the sort of Wild West days of it and how big it was before the storm. Tell me a little bit how Galveston fits into Dead First.
It's ultimately where the story is leading to, is getting to Galveston, and that was always the plan when I came up with this idea. I grew up not on the Texas coast, but on the Mississippi coast. But nonetheless, I've been fascinated by the idea of the coast. I've been fascinated by, when I was a kid, maybe one of the scariest things in the world to me, as much as I love ghost stories, the specter of hurricanes living along the coast. The Gulf Coast was always present every year. And I'm, you know, I don't know if they still do this for kids now, but like they used to give us hurricane maps in school at the beginning of the school year, because I was also like in the midst of hurricane season and basically take this home, make sure your parents are aware of it, yada, yada. Galveston is the site, like you mentioned, the storm, the 1900 storm, the worst natural disaster in terms of loss of life to ever hit the United States. And prior to that, it had been the crown jewel of the Texas coast, and people thought it was basically going to be what Houston ended up becoming, which is in and of itself this its own bizarre story, because not to you know, insult the islander necessarily, but to a certain extent, Galveston is a glorified sandbar. And the idea that a storm was never going to come and wipe it out at some point was just kind of delusional. But nonetheless, at the time, prior to the storm, it was the jewel of the coast.
And then after the storm, it was sort of neglected and became a haven for the ne'er-do-wells?
Yes. I mean, there's the Maceo family, you know, related to the mob, moved in, and by mob standards of the era, from, you know, the early 20th century up to about World War II, they ran the city with, you know, pretty, you know, an open kind of environment. And it was called the Free State of Galveston because vice kind of ran rampant and you could kind of go there and do whatever you wanted to. And there was definitely still some violence by, you know, the standard of like comparing it to like Chicago during Prohibition. It was nowhere near as much of a bloodbath. So there's kind of a romantic viewpoint. If you read people that write about that era that are from there and go to, you know, some of the landmarks that people remember, oh, this was owned by them. There was a, you know, I think 2005, it might have been later, but there was a hurricane relatively recently in the 21st century that destroyed a ballroom that had gone out, the Balinese room that used to go out on a pier into the Gulf. And there were all these wonderful stories about, oh, this is how they used to trick the cops with the different rooms and different ways to trap them in a maze, kind of while we hid all the gambling and the women and everything when they were coming to raid the place. And there's all this, you know, this element of romanticized. And meanwhile, like there were also, if you read a little deeper and dig deeper into newspaper clippings, which I kind of get into a little bit in the story, it's like, yeah, there were also witnesses being murdered and dumped in the Gulf and things like that happening.
You know,
so it's fascinating.
It's similar here in Chicago with Al Capone, in that, you know, you'd go by as a kid, your parents would tell you that was one of Al Capone's hideouts, or, you know, this was his hotel. And in fact, I'm sitting now about a mile from a road that was his route from Wisconsin, from his home in Wisconsin. Mm. He'd come down this road, Highway 43, and the stories from the old town residents here would be that they would call ahead to the cops, and the cops would be sure that they were far away from the route when they went by. So it's kind of a universal thing, I think.
It's fascinating, and it's at once fun, and at the same time, you don't want to lose sight of the fact, what happened.
People
lost their lives, regardless, right. And there's this ugly underbelly to it.
Tell me about, take me to your writing, and how do you write scary? I mean, do you write scary in a way different, I would imagine, than you would write a romance novel or a thriller? Or, I mean, how do you write scary?
Trying to get to the core of hopefully what will scare somebody, because scary is so subjective, is one of the most difficult and yet rewarding things to do. I try to base my idea of what I hope will scare people on what kind of things, basically, when I test drive these concepts with friends and family, what kind of things consistently seem to get a response from somebody. And I think most consistently, you know, some people have a different response to blood than others. You know, some people can tolerate it, etc. Some people, you know, if you showcase some kind of the idea of some kind of elder god or you know, like Cthulhu style cosmic horror of you know, something that's overwhelming the mind, some people are like, that's just so horrifying, and other people are like, eh. But I tend to find consistently, like, if you hear a knock and you can't identify it in your house late at night, basically everybody's like, what the hell was that? There's nobody I've talked to that's like, well, when I hear that, I just kind of like figure, eh, no big deal. It's like, if I can't identify this, or if I hear a strange voice, you know, from behind a wall and I wasn't prepared for that. And then maybe you go into the room and you find out somebody just left the television on. And then it's like, even then, well, wait.
Then you're not sure. It's true.
Yeah. Did somebody else leave it on? Did it come back on? It's these kind of little unknown elements even when I'm writing some of the other things, because I try to explore the full tapestry of horror, but even when I'm writing some of those other elements, if I can get in that sound that makes you feel unsettled, that shadow that makes you feel like, why is that there? Did I see something out the corner of my eye? Those little things, I feel like, pretty consistently freak people out. So even if you're trying to write just about a more direct form of horror, if you can incorporate those subtle things, I feel like that's going to resonate, hopefully, with more people. And then, ultimately, you kind of leave it in the hands of the audience, because, again, horror is super subjective. So the backup plan for me is always, I hope the story is good.
Right.
Even if you're not scared, hopefully you find the story compelling.
Okay, I don't believe in ghosts, but how many times do you hear that? I don't believe in ghosts, but I was spending the night one night in Oxford in England in a hotel. And I would wake up through the night and I would see the clock. There was a clock above the, like, just adjacent to the top of the doorway. And I'd keep waking up, seeing the clock. And when I got up the next morning, there was no clock there. And
see. I mean, that's, you know, it's so
Johnny, so I check, when we're checking out, I say, hey, is this place haunted by any means? And they're like, well, what did you see? Because we do have people who see things. And someone said that really was this ghostly sign. I don't know. It didn't change my mind, but I did have that experience. And you're kind of the same way, right? You saw a ghost.
I'm the exact same way. I never say that I believe in ghosts, because I fundamentally, in my heart, I just can't bring myself to say I believe in it. Nonetheless, if you go to my social media, you know, there's the long version of it, but short version of it is I did see something mm-hmm. that looked like an apparition, a full-bodied apparition, as they call it. I could see it. It was a little girl that I thought was there, and I speak with my hands. I started to point toward her in my house, and then she vanished right before my eyes. And that happened to me when I was a teenager, and or maybe when I was about 20. I forget exactly, but I was young, and I've you know, over 20 years now since that happened, and I still wonder about it. And everybody who I know who does believe hardcore in ghosts, if they heard your story, they would tell you the same thing that they always tell me, which is that we're in denial. Like, what do you mean you actually saw this thing?
Right.
And you know you saw it, and yet you're still. And I would just say, I think our brains are really bizarre. Who knows? I think something went wrong with the wiring, and I manifested something. I don't know why I never saw it again, anything like that. Just like you, you've probably never seen anything like that clock ever again.
No.
But who knows?
Johnny Compton, the name of this book is Dead First, and it was great to talk to you. I appreciate it. I'll read everything you write from now on just to see if the state hospital comes up, or that you can use the clock on the wall, too. Either of those, that's my gift to you, Johnny.
I mean, the clock on the wall is fantastic, too. Both of those are really good. I mean, you should at least try your hand at it if you want to, because those are both perfect forecasts for some scary stories.
I'll start with a horror haiku. We'll see where it goes from there.
There you go.
All right, nice to talk to you. Be well.
Likewise. Thank you.
Okay, prepare yourself to meet Barbara Rosenberg. I caught up with novelist Jordy Rosenberg as he was visiting his family far, far away, and had a chance to talk to him about his book, Night Fawn.
Yeah, I'm in Auckland, New Zealand, visiting my sister, and it's very warm.
That's nice. This book is fascinating to me, this character, Barbara Rosenberg. You described the book as a midtown, mid-century comedic noir, which mm-hmm. are a lot of syllables there. Explain that for me.
I'm trying to efficiently condense the mashup of genres that are going on here. There's this strong comedic element that comes out of my antagonism with and influenced by a certain kind of Rothian tradition of comedic writing. But then there's also a gothic element that a kind of a horror element that I was working in there that I'm happy to discuss further. But that was a sort of compressed way of trying to get at what the book's trying to do, just stylistically, I guess I would say.
I mentioned the name Barbara Rosenberg, and she is the, the narrator on two fronts of this book. One is kind of a memoir, which seems pretty reliable, fairly reliable. And then the other is more up to date or true and current day. I guess she's dying of cancer. She's pumped up on opioids. And she describes what she's seeing in her final days. you could have done that better, but how did I do on that explanation?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so the book is, yes, you did great. The book is a fictionalized diary of a woman named Barbara Rosenberg, who is, I think, you know, she's a transphobic mother who's dying, and she is being taken care of by an estranged transgender son, who she also has come to believe is a person-sized hawk, demanding that she write essentially like an apology for her life in the form of a memoir. And Barbara doesn't really want to apologize, so there's a tension in how she's going to narrate her life. But she believes that she's basically being threatened by this transgender hawk to write an account of her choices.
The first thing that jumps out, Jordy, is that she shares your last name.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, you might have chosen a lot of names for this woman, and you chose yours. Why is that?
Well, you know, it is a novel, but it did start as a memoir that was written from my perspective. I'll tell it kind of a narrative version of how the novel came about. I had been writing some memoir pieces that were published in the Los Angeles Review of Books, like maybe almost 15 years ago. In the course of doing that, I did a reading of one of the pieces, one of these memoir pieces. And there is one point in this memoir piece where I speak in my mother's voice. And that was the moment in reading that people really responded to. There was like a moment of absolute breakout laughter. She had, I was quoting something that she had said in life many decades ago when I had come out to her, and she was absolutely, I mean, I would say horrified in an existential way, like just it destroyed her life from her perspective. Mm-hmm. And we argued for a couple years, and then eventually we became very estranged. But at one point in my, you know, like late teens, early 20s, I thought I had gotten her. I thought, all right, here's the talking point that she's just not going to be able to argue with. And I think I said, look, I just don't like I don't like sleeping with men. And she said, and she really got me here. She said, no one likes sleeping with men. Just marry one and divorce him for the alimony. And so when I said this line in reading this piece of memoir, people really, really laughed. I mean, really responded. And I guess it made me... That was the moment I really couldn't get beyond, that moment of breakthrough laughter when I was doing my mother's voice. And I really had to think, what was I doing there in channeling her voice? That's the moment that kind of became novelistic to me.
Did you learn anything about your mother in writing this novel about Barbara Rosenberg?
You know, I want to say no. And the reason that I want to say no is because I really have to strenuously insist that although the name is Barbara Rosenberg, this is a fictional character.
Sure,
so
okay.
There are things that happen between myself and my mother that really depart from what happens in the book. One of the things that I mean by that is that going back to that moment of speaking in my mother's voice, what are we doing when we're satirizing a parent? What are we doing when we're satirizing someone whose politics we really disagree with? There's a level of, to take a psychoanalytic view of this, of aggression toward that person that you're expressing through satire. There's a level of confrontation with those political ideologies, I think. And so... I think that writing a satire from this character's perspective is a way of confronting at the same time the question of our entanglement with those, mm-hmm. with those people, ideologies, politics, and also confronting them, ridiculing them, poking fun at it. In real life, my relationship with my mother, there were elements of, reconciliation. I mean, when you're taking care of someone, who knows if they were genuine or not, but when you're taking care of someone who's utterly dependent on you, they're going to reconcile with you.
Well, and good on you for doing it. But I don't want readers to get the wrong impression.
Okay.
This book is so much fun to read. I mean, it is this Barbara Rosenberg. I feel like I've known her all my life.
The book is, well, that's why I led with the description of it as a comedic noir. I mean, it's comedy. I really let loose with Barbara's voice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a character that a lot of people will recognize. She is a hardcore Yenta. She's Brooklyn born. She's describing her life there's many touch points throughout the decades. She's working as like the front office receptionist for garment trucking in Midtown in the 60s. She's working in a plastic surgeon's office as a receptionist in the 80s. This plastic surgeon is like a mid-level, you know, he's like the boob guy for the Brighton Beach Bratva mistresses. Like, that's who he is. She's the like face of this operation. You know, there's a lot of comedy. And I did intentionally like want to lean into the book as a kind of like just total, rant, just let her rant.
She did. And it was fun to read. I think I'm interested too in her friend Sugar, and they were close together in school. Sugar had more success in a field that Barbara wanted to have success in, and then they became estranged, and Sugar comes back into her life. Now, I'm not clear, Jordy, mm-hmm. how physical the reunification was, right? The reunion was. But Sugar's back in Barbara's life and Barbara's world.
Yeah. Okay, so you just want to know a little bit about that relationship?
I want to know a couple things. I mean, I'm interested in their relationship, but it's a sense of loss on Barbara's part. And she says something to me that, you know, really resonated with me. She said, "There can be no trust between old friends without mutually confessing the indignities that our lives have been dealt."
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know if you agree with me, but that's a pretty good litmus test for friendship.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really interested in exploring. I mean, this is a book. There's a lot in here that's about Barbara's relationship with her husband and her frustrations in her marriage. But it is. I didn't go into it wanting to write about female friendship. I never thought, my next book is going to be about female friendship in a million years.
Right.
But it's like, once you start writing that character, you kind of are inhabiting her obsessions. And one of her obsessions is this relationship with her best friend. And to me, that was a more interesting way to track the development of this character. It's very much about her relationship with, I think, Sugar as an ego ideal, the woman that she would have liked to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is about Barbara's self-conception. There's so much of our self-conception, I think, that is bound up in our friendships, right? Because they're like, for Barbara, this is like an alternate version of her life.
I want to ask you about another quote that has to do with your writing in general. And because I've been around books and authors for a long time. I'm not sure I understand it. You said you were happy that you found the imprint One World mm-hmm. to publish with. And yet it's part of Random House. So yeah. how is the imprint distinguished from the overall house? Or you know what I mean? Why could it have not been any Random House imprint?
Oh, wait, well, it could have, but And I mean, there's so many like wonderful kind of like pockets of, you know, editorial sort of styles and zeitgeist within these larger publishing houses. But One World is a very special operation. It's the imprint that I published my first book with, and I feel very loyal to them and attached to them. They have managed to cultivate a real culture of, you know, just an incredible amount of like leeway and respect for authorial choices. They cultivate quite an eclectic, often very leftist list. I don't know if they have to do a lot of work in sort of representing and justifying those choices up the chain, but whatever they do have to do, they really protect authors from having to know about it. It just feels, it really feels almost like you're, I don't know what it would feel like to publish with an independent press, but I love so many independent presses, and I would love, you know, to have a relationship with them for like, say, and I don't know if I was doing something maybe more experimental, but it feels to my mind a little bit like what it might be to be publishing at an independent press, because there's such a kind of like supportive and yet a supportive sort of atmosphere for trying novelistic and, say, political experiments there.
Jordy Rosenberg is here. The name of the book is Night, Night, Fawn. Jordy, when I was getting ready to prepare the interview and the introduction for you, I was tempted to start with Jordy is a transgender writer. And then I was thinking that's maybe too limiting, and I looked at a lot of the media, and that's sort of how they identified you first. And I just wonder what you think of that.
Yeah. Well, what I think about that is that, first of all, I can see that the question itself is a really thoughtful one, so I appreciate it. What you're asking, my feeling about this question, which actually isn't something I think about too much, but now that you put it to me, my feeling is that I am a trans author, and I don't have a problem at all with being thought of that way. There will be people who do so in bad faith, but ultimately, I have commitments to many communities. Trans readers are one of them. I've been very supported by that readership. I come from that readership, and in many ways, when I'm writing, I am thinking of them. I do feel that a broad readership has, in many ways, found their way to fiction written by trans authors. And I guess my utopian perspective is that a broad readership will find their way to fiction written by trans authors. But I also feel that that's not something we can really control in the realm of fine-tuning how we're identified in interviews or publicity or marketing materials. We're really asking a question about the realm of the political.
Right.
It has something to do with the fact this horizon, I guess you could say, where a broad readership is finding their way to fiction written by trans people, has to do with the fact that trans people, and hinges upon the fact that trans people, share interests and investments with people more generally, healthcare. The ability to realize ourselves in a community, freedom from miseration. However much the far right has tried to excise trans people from the social order, trans people are people. And we are all engaged in a political project together. So I think with any writers, you have a question of the particularity of that writer and maybe of the community that they're coming from, and a question of the universality, not to sound cheesy, but of fiction and of politics and of life and our historical context. So,
the way I try to put it, and I put it badly about this in general, not just the transgender issue, but, you know, we focus, there are too many thems in our society today. There aren't enough us's. And in the end, we're all us. We're all us, right? I mean, it doesn't matter what color our skin is, what gender we are. It's a big us, and we got to embrace us rather than point at them.
Yes, yes. I mean, I agree. I think that, you know, I mean, you're, you know, sort of gesturing toward the terrible political moment that we find ourselves in. Mm-hmm. And it is a terrible, truly, I mean, shatteringly terrible political moment. But it's also the case that the level of popular resistance and the ways in which people are finding each other in coalition, which is what you mean, right? By
right.
people, we're
sure.
all just people. The way that people are finding each other in coalition is incredible, and around certain issues, unprecedented, I would say, in my lifetime in particular. And you know, this is something we touched on a little bit, but around Palestine solidarity, the level of coalitional solidarity in support of Palestinian people is truly unprecedented.
Are you left with optimism at this point, or an overwhelming, overriding pessimism?
Don't. You're setting me up for the pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
Oh no, I'm not.
It's too perfect. I mean, that is. I think that is how I feel. I mean, it's. I think. I don't know. I don't think I'm alone in feeling constantly devastated, and then, but also just overwhelmed and moved on a daily basis. Aren't you? But the level of, you know, bravery of people and courage and resistance.
Yeah. So I suppose if light is at the end of the tunnel, and speaking for myself, I know the end of the tunnel is coming, but I have a few curves to get there first. Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a really difficult, I guess, if you have a minute for me to say, one writing project I've been involved in most recently while I was at McDowell is a writing project with the two authors, Iman Abdelhadi and Michelle O'Brien. They wrote a speculative fiction, a work of speculative fiction called Everything for Everyone. And now they're putting, that was wonderful. And it was kind of about a post-revolutionary society.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're putting together a collection where they're having other authors that they know try to contribute new chapters to this post-revolutionary world. And everyone just was given the mandate, you know, write a short story that takes place in this world. So you have to imagine a world that is a post-revolutionary society, and what are the conflicts that might come up? What are the political situations that might come up? It's a little bit of a utopian exercise in thinking that, all right, we could have a revolution, and then what would the world look like? I can't tell you, even as someone involved in organizing who tries to maintain some kind of utopian horizon on a daily basis, I found this incredibly difficult, like maybe the most difficult writing
interesting
assignment I've ever done, because it is hard to have that. You're describing it as a light at the end of the tunnel. It is hard to keep that in mind and to feel it in a concrete way. And sometimes we can't access that feeling. Some days we can't, some moments you just can't. But I really, really appreciated the sort of, you know, the urging of friends and comrades to keep going toward that, even as an intellectual exercise. But it is an important one. It's inextricable from the other political work that we're doing.
Yeah, and I think we're not going to get there unless we all work to get there. So I'm glad you're doing your part, and I appreciate you joining us from New Zealand. How's your, does your sister mind you sharing time with us?
Yeah, she's really annoyed that I'm working all the time, but she's working too. So, you know.
Well, listen, I really enjoy talking to you and getting to know you, and I wish you the best, and I hope we can talk again.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Steve.
That's Julie Rosenberg. The book is Night, Night, Fawn. Earlier, you heard from Johnny Compton about his latest. It's called Dead First. That's going to wrap things up for Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you're listening. I'd love to know what you think of the podcast. Send me an email at stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com. Until next time, be well.